Welcome back, everyone, to Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. I'm your host, Doug Kameen, and today I'm talking with Chris Zimmerman, Senior Director of IT at Fleet Farm in Appleton, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Doug. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah. So we were talking a little bit before the show about what you're most interested in, if you will. And you told me that you're most interested in your leadership journey, and you spend a lot of time focused on that. So let's just lead right off with that and talk. Give us some background on what that means to you.
Yeah, that sounds great. So leadership to me is really important because you want to make sure that you're taking care of your employees and really making sure that you have that good rapport with the organization. I'm really big into the culture, trying to make sure that we have a culture that's encouraging and supporting the employees. You know, leadership can mean so many different things to so many different people. And you really, what I found, even outside of leadership, honestly, within an organization, you really need to have an understanding for how the organization works. You know, what's the life cycle of the organization? Mm-hmm. There's the fiscal calendar and all those fun things. But also, you also need to understand what's the right size for the organization, no matter what you're doing. So if you take project management, for example, you come into an organization and, you know, this actually happened to me. I was brought into an organization to start a project management organization. And, you know, you get in there and you're like, oh, I'm gonna show them what's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and bring in Microsoft Project, and you know, you're running all these projects with full charters and things like that. And pretty soon your project team is like, yeah, we don't have Microsoft Project, so we can't see what you're talking about. So then you end up reporting it. Yeah. You know, that was a great lesson for me in just making sure that things are right size. So soon I just reverted back to Excel. Was like, okay, just a simple form. Communication is the most important thing, not the fact that we're using the right tool or the wrong tool. It's the right thing for the organization. So that goes into a lot of different areas, but also into leadership and making sure that you understand the culture of the organization, and then also what culture that you want to drive. No matter what kind of leadership style you have, first and foremost with leadership, you really need to make sure that you're getting results, and getting results in the right way, so that, you know, no matter if you've got the best programs and the best culture in the organization, but if you just can't get projects over the finish line, or, you know, the budget's constantly blown, you're not going to last very long in leadership in having those particular issues. So that's definitely one of the things that you need to keep in mind right up front. And then I'm always trying to be a man of action. So making sure we're keeping momentum within the organization and moving forward all the time is so important to make sure that you've got the momentum and you maintain the momentum for the organization. It just, you know, it builds confidence within the organization, but then also within yourself, within the team members as well, because confidence is really built on your past successes. And that's what really keeps people going. So just some other points real quick, you know, making sure to take risks. Even outside of an organization, you know, taking risks with your career. So as an example, when I wanted to go from individual contributor through to a functional leader, mm-hmm. I actually took a risk of working farther away from home. So I would drive roughly an hour one way to get mm-hmm. to that job. You know, it was in a more rural area of the state. And so
most of Wisconsin kind of rural.
The Eastern Corp. Yes, there's a lot of rural areas. That is true. Yeah. So it's just making sure to take those risks, because that can be important for your career as well. If, you know, you've got a goal, keep your eye on the prize and take those risks so that you can get to that goal.
Mm-hmm. So right out of the chute, we're starting with some great advice here. I'm going to divert you right into, this is my shtick, is that I love plumbing the depths with our guests about what drives them to want to be leaders and why, and what they find the most important. I'm going to ask you, in your current role, you know, you've been there a while. You know, I have the LinkedIn cheat sheet here. You've been with Fleet Farm, I think is the name, right? Did I get that right? Is it Farms or Farm?
Just Farm.
Fleet Farm. So there's only one Farm. There's only one Fleet Farm, but lots of locations. that are single farm.
Our 50th store right now. That's great.
That's awesome. So with Fleet Farm, you've been there a number of years, and you've had a long time to really get settled and move through different roles. What things have you brought into that organization from a leadership perspective about, like, what's the biggest thing that you value, and what's the biggest thing that you've, like, if I was to say to you, you came in, you were asked to be a leader, what impact did you have with the staff in leading the team and building it out? What would you want to share?
Yeah, I think I would say there's two different things. So one is, again, going back to that action, getting things done. That's been one of the keys to my success is to make sure that we're not just looking at things that we could do or stuck in analysis by paralysis, but we're moving forward and getting things done. The team, I often say, the team makes the impossible possible. You know, the teams that I've had the pleasure to lead and the department that I have now, they do a fantastic job of really knocking things out of the park, you know, project after project. It is so often. So if you take, for example, when COVID hit, and you were a retail organization, brick and mortar. So how did your shopping habits change during COVID? What did you do that was different?
Now, yeah, well, we all started deciding that suddenly Instacart was great. And, you know, I'm going to shop less. I'm going to shop at 7 a.m. in the morning or 8:45 at night, or, you know, just all these various avoidance tactics for quite a while there, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so what the team had to do was quickly shift and adjust to meet those demands. And it wasn't, you know, okay, you got 18 months to get this project out the door. It's like, no, like buy online, pick up at store, for example, you had 3 days to get that done. Okay. Mm-hmm. The shift was so significant and so fast. Thankfully, you know, the team was able to execute that buy online, pick up in store very, very quickly. The other one that happened to a lot of organizations was self-checkout. You know, and there's not enough labor to be had. There's too much demand from shoppers. So putting in self-checkout. Well, at Fleet Farm, we were able to get the self-checkout from inception all the way to first transactions in 4 months, which is unbelievable.
I just want to ask about self-checkout, because this is surfaced in the news at various intervals more recently about a number of retailers moving away from self-checkout because, well, I mean, people are like, oh, look, oops, that didn't scan. Yeah. And, you know, it moves across the line. So, like, from an IT perspective, what things have you done to try to minimize that? Like, I mean, because there's strategies, you know, like you can, you know, there's the scales in these systems to weigh each item that it goes across and other stuff. And certain, you know, you have to like weigh the benefits versus the consequences. Like if you do this one thing, it annoys the consumers enough that they're like, I don't want to use this thing. But if you don't, then somebody's like, ooh, I can take advantage of that. So I was just curious, like, how'd you fight that fight?
Yeah, so there, you're exactly right. There's a couple of different tools. So one is around, you know, there's the camera analytics piece of it. There's always the cameras that can keep an eye on what's being scanned. There's also the weight scales, as you described, so that you know kind of how much things weigh. In addition, you've got processes and human intervention as well. So at our stores, thankfully, we didn't we didn't go crazy on self checkout. It was more containerized, if you will, so that one person, the attendant, can watch all of the different self checkouts. And that helps tremendously, just having that, knowing that person is there and that they're keeping an eye on things, and not only keeping an eye on things, but they're to serve the customers as well. You know, you touched on the annoyance. There's been a lot in the news about people not liking self checkout. Well, having that attendant there to be able to help, you know, rather than one attendant to 18 self-checkouts, you know, if you have 1 to 4 or something like that, they can be more attentive and be able to help the customer have a better journey within the store. So yeah, that's a little about self-checkout and why I think it's a great example of how well that the team does at making the impossible possible for the organization.
Attention all of my IT leaders who don't know a lot about telecom. Many of you are still managing a pile of junk and you've inherited a telecom silo. I call it a telecom time bomb. Many of us are ignoring it because the enormity of tasks surrounding a phone system replacement is overwhelming, and there's a constant barrage of direct sales reps trying to get you into a new UCaaS system today. And the whole process ends up being filled with an unforeseen comedy of errors. However, for those of you tackling such a task, you must answer, number one, are you going to go Microsoft Teams, or are you going to do something else? If it is Teams, then there's only three ways to do it, and the worst way is by just clicking the button and paying that expensive voice-enabling Teams button in your CSP's portal or asking them to do it for you. Okay, so you're not 100% sold on Teams yet because your company has a unique group of end users. Good for you for caring. Then you may be wondering, and you need to answer all these questions. Which platforms and interfaces have easy to self-manage portals, GUIs, so that you can make moves, ads, and changes on the fly? Which platforms are the most upgradable and have functioning APIs who will truly interoperate with your systems? Who's going to give you free equipment and headsets, of course, and be the most cost-effective? Who's going to support your team the best with fast technical support in minutes, not days? And who's going to meet your compliancy requirements now and in the future with flexible user licensing? How about network preparation, ensuring quality of service and properly layering voice applications? How do you confidently ensure a smooth cutover and avoid going in with your fingers crossed? How do you negotiate all the legal ramifications of FCC regulated SLAs that affect your terms and conditions? Things like elasticity clauses and out of contracts if they fail to deliver. How do you know what your end users are thinking and how to deal with explaining technical to people 1,000 times that don't know how to do a transfer? And even if you have all this down, what do you do if you have limited time to research, evaluate, and confidently plan a network communications upgrade that will surely impress your key stakeholders with return on investment, CapEx, OpEx, all of this stuff? Evaluate and where do you get started in an ocean of vendors? Which provider mix is going to best fit your company's culture versus just asking your peers who they use or shopping VoIP.com or Googling who's the best, and then you've got all kinds of people showing up in your inbox. This is why this is the classic put-off project where no one wants to take on the planning from start to finish, everything from auditing bills to surveying staff, researching providers, sifting through information, meeting with vendors, requesting proposals, ensuring all the effective transition without outages, and managing all of the negative Nancy naysayers who are surely going to complain about the new phone system. Let me and my special team of telecom nerds give you all of the rollout maps, RFP grids, and hold you by the hand for free and even pit providers against them and give you all of the data information on what the lowest pricing has ever been with benchmark level pricing. Everything from seeing how far you can throw those old phone systems to every detail you need surrounding Microsoft Teams integrations or all of the best UCaaS providers with custom and in and out of the box APIs. Also, some of you are dealing with who's the best fit contact center software providers for your unique group of end users and agents and staff. How can you leverage AI software to drastically increase agent efficiency? And let's not forget about workforce management tools to ensure proper staffing, all while avoiding annoying meetings and sales reps telling you it's the end of the month, President's Day specials. All you need to do is email telecom@popularit.net and we will give you all of the information, everything you need, and hold you by the hand for free. And if you like the information, great, do whatever you want with it. And if not, you can tell us to go pound sand.
So I was thinking about your experience. The last six, you know, almost 6 years you've been with Fleet Farm. It's a retail establishment. You know, you mentioned 200 stores. Is that?
We're building our
50 stores. I'm sorry. So 50 stores. Retail is its own beast, if you will, of management and IT challenges and stuff like that. In the past, you haven't worked in retail. What is different about leading IT in retail that you find unique, or that, you know, unique challenges and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, because you're right. I've worked across my career. I've worked in banking and services, in manufacturing, and now in retail. So it has been quite the journey, and I've been able to see kind of how IT works differently within the different organizations. I will say that in the different industries, I will say that, you know, IT, if some components of IT don't change very much and very drastically. So when you're talking about infrastructure, computer security, you know, those components tend to stay relatively the same. Yes, there's some different peripherals, but when you're talking about servers and things like that, it's fairly straightforward. But then there are other changes that you alluded to. So for example, when I was in manufacturing and you put in Wi-Fi across the entire campus of building, mm-hmm. and, you know, you're doing your wireless surveys because you don't want the wireless to leave the four walls of the building. Now contrast that when I get to Fleet Farm and you have customer Wi-Fi. Never even crossed my mind. You got customer Wi-Fi. So not only are you allowing it to bleed outside, but you're actually encouraging people to use it within your own walls. So that was kind of a different thought that I have to, you know, a shift that I had to make getting into the retail IT. And then, you know, the functions within retail IT are different than some of the manufacturing ones. So for example, you know, in manufacturing, you've got the ERP modules that are slightly different than the ERP modules that you have in retail, because of course you're trying to do omni-channel sales. you know, across e-commerce, in store, and really allow the customer to be serviced wherever they are. So those are some of the differences that I've noticed with retail in comparison to other areas of IT that are industries of IT industries that I've been in.
Yeah, I could see like point of sale systems. I'm thinking about, you know, having to run a fleet of point of sale systems is its own nightmare in a certain way, because there's a lot of them. They get touched. They're these high touch machines that I don't want to say they break a lot. I mean, I don't really know their break ratio as compared to other things, but there's a lot of moving parts, if you will. You've got a pin pad, you've got a register. It has to connect to a server at a store. Then there's multiple stores that it has to consolidate to somewhere else. There's just a lot of parts to
the system. Exactly. And obviously in retail, cash registers are the area that you really want to focus on. You know, when you're talking about manufacturing, let's say, then it's the machines. You know, if the machine goes down, then the entire process is going to break down. So Yeah, you definitely have to think about that differently. And like I said, you have the different peripherals that are out there across the industries.
Yeah. So you alluded to this just a minute ago, but you know, your past history, you've worked at a lot of different establishments. Can you tell us a little bit about, our listeners love to hear about the different roles that people have played in their past. So tell us a little bit how you got to now, if you will. Like, sure. How did you start? Where did you start in IT when you were, you know, you're always like, I'm going to be an IT, you know, when you're a kid. You're like, I was a computer guy. I was going to be an IT. This is what I was going to do. I was destined for this. Or did you stumble into it? You know, I was a psychology major and I was gonna be in the marching band.
Yeah. For me, it is a bit of a unique journey from others that I've met in IT, because I didn't start out in IT. My first career was in computer science, so I got a degree in computer science, and then
I have one of those.
You do? Okay.
I do. I'm a computer science major, not in IT. I do not have a degree in IT.
Yeah, so worked for about 5 years in that industry across, you know, for local police departments, and then interestingly enough in loss prevention for a retail organization. Just kind of
when you worked for a police department, you were not an officer. You worked.
I was a community service officer.
Community service. What is that?
So that they're able to help out the police department so that they don't have to do some of the minor incidents, if you will, like animal control. Bikes, skateboards, you know, closing down parks, ramps.
Okay. All right.
Take some of the weight off of the officers so that they can focus on other things. Yeah. So that was
the rabid raccoons were your problem.
Exactly. Both of those jobs definitely taught me a lot, you know, taught me that, you know, although you have lots of weapons at your disposal, if you will, when you're in police science, you know, your tongue and your mouth, they're definitely your best weapons, because if you can get somebody to calm down but just by talking through it, that's much better than some of the alternatives that you have. So really learned how to communicate with other people a lot better from that particular degree, that's for sure, in that work experience. Then from there, after you know, after working in loss prevention for a while, you know, those industries, they kind of become a young man's game pretty quickly. Went back to school, said, you know, this computer thing, it seems to be catching on. So maybe I'll try that. So went back to school and got a degree in computer networking, started working up through my career, you know, started on the infrastructure side, help desk, then up to systems engineer. Eventually decided that I wanted to get back into school. And really focus on leadership. Then I went back to school, got a bachelor's degree in leadership and organizational studies.
You got a lot of different degrees here. You were bordering on professional student for a while here.
Exactly. What's worked really well for me, and I don't know if this is my personality, I don't know why, but I'll work for a period of time and then I'll go back to school and work full time at the same time. That's been a really, really good formula for me.
So you go through cycles of really expanding your knowledge after a period of time. You know, you spend out working, doing, you know, hands-on stuff, and you kind of reflect. okay, now this thing here, I'm going to expand my knowledge again. And then that builds on what you have before, but also adds to the pile of what you can do.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, Doug, because, you know, as you grow through your career, you can reach a ceiling, if you will. And it's like, okay, I need more knowledge. So then I typically will head back to school. So, you know, then got into project management, then functional management. And then I started, you know, through that functional management journey, I started really interacting with the business a lot more, not just around IT, but around process, around, you know, finance, whatever it may be. So then I went back for what's so far been my final, MBA. And so that's, it all worked full time. And that was quite the journey in itself, because I met a lot of great people through that program. We did it as a cohort. So every Saturday for 16 months, the same people, we all got together 9-10 hours every Saturday, and really grinding out the MBA. Met a lot of not only great students, but also great teachers, a lot of great friends now. That's been fantastic. And that growing that network is always important as well, you know, so that I'm constantly bouncing ideas off of other CIOs, off of professors, off of students, because when I got my MBA, you know, there was CEOs, there were COOs in my class. Mm-hmm. So it's great experience to be able to bounce those ideas off of somebody else who has a way different perspective from me. So yeah, that's been my journey. Like I said, it's been unique because it started off different, and then it's just continued to take off for me. So it's mm-hmm. been
from community policing to IT. Quite the dramatic shift. And it's a great story and a great, you know, arc to share with folks to demonstrate the different ways that people get into this. You know, and this is the part that's unique is your journey. The part that's not unique is that other people often have these very not direct journeys into this field. Yeah. There's a lot of people who, you know, we've talked to on the podcast over time that are like, oh man, I never even laid a hand on a computer until I was like 18. You know, I went to college and my parents were like, you know, computers aren't the future. You should go work with your hands, son. You know, and then next thing you know, they go to college and maybe a trade school or whatever the case may be. And they get in front of something and they're like, oh my gosh, this is my eyes have been opened to this. So yeah, these different ways of seeing how people get to where they are is really enlightening and insightful. I think your journey of being able to go work, school, work, school, work, school, this continuous desire to learn is one of the, you know, that's one of those like alternative paths that a lot of people end up following. And it could represent its own challenges too, because you mentioned like grinding it out for 16 months on Saturdays. That's a big lift.
Yep. Working full time, having two kids, you know, it's definitely not for everybody. It definitely can be difficult. It's not an easy path, you know, but every path has its challenges. So,
yeah. And you mentioned, also that during that, the MBA in particular, you were sitting with CEOs and other folks like that. So I already know the answer here is it is very valuable, but what methodologies or tools or strategies have you used to make sure that you're able to network? You mentioned that your MBA provided you with an opportunity to sit with CEOs, CIOs, people who are above where you were sitting in that moment. And in those opportunities, what other ways would you suggest to listeners of the podcast that they might be able to expand their horizons as well in their networks?
Yeah, I think the thing that you need to remember for the most part is that people want to help you, especially those people that are, you know, towards the top. If you have a compelling story or a compelling question for them, they'll typically answer you. For example, when I was getting my MBA, you know, there's a really good book that I was reading, The Adventures of an IT Leader. If you guys haven't read that book, it's, even as IT people, it's really good to read that book because it gives you the perspective from the business of IT. And it really just kind of lays it out. It was the first time that I'd ever heard that portrayed in that way. But through that MBA journey, I also ran across the research of like Joe Peppard. Joe is a professor over at Spurfit in Ireland, and Joe is he's got some great research. He's willing to help you. Very similar story with others as well. I can't tell you how many people that I have that mentored me along the way. Whether that's David Richter, who was the CIO of Petco, or Gene Bernier, who was the interim CIO of Kimberly-Clark. These guys, you think, oh, they don't have time for me. You know, I'm not even going to try. just try. They may be willing to help you. You know, again, you've got to really have a compelling question for them or a story. They're not just gonna, you know, reach out to anybody who may reach out to them. But we want to help. We want to grow the next generation as well. And you know, oftentimes what's the same things that we ran into as we were growing through organizations are the same thing that you're going to go through. You know, I'm reading Marcus Aurelius's Meditations right now. 1,000 years old. He didn't intend for anybody to find the book. It's his journal. You read some of these snippets and it's like, this was 2,000 years ago. This sounds like exactly like what I'm going through today. And it's like nothing has changed. It's kind of crazy. So I would say that definitely be bold, reach out to people on LinkedIn, you know, do networking locally as well, whether that's through an organization. There's oftentimes IT organizations that are around in your area, and there are people that are going to want to help you.
So I have a whole bit on something you said a minute ago about people wanting to help you. I would qualify that. And I would say that no, it's finding the people who, if the people want to help you, those are the people you want to engage with, if you will. So like, there are some people out there that are pretty cutthroat and they're like, no, this is my thing. I'm going to do my thing. And that I would presume that that's the minority of folks that are out there. But we've had bad relationships with people in the past. You know, there are people out there that are toxic to interface with, and they're not worth that effort and time. So like, I think I would, my qualification to what you said is that the people who you want to engage with already do want to help you. And the people who don't want to help you are definitely people you didn't want to engage with anyways, and therefore you shouldn't pursue it.
That's a great way to put it.
Now, I'm going to go back a little bit to you mentioned something about your community policing work.
Yeah.
And specifically, I'm going to reframe this into something you highlighted about leadership. You mentioned about it helping you understand how your mouth and your tongue were the most important tools that you had.
Yeah.
And can you talk a little more about the lessons that you learned about how to approach people and what specific things, like what did you, well, tell me more about it. I'll just leave it at that. Let me just open end that one.
So, you know, as someone who, you know, it's not as though in that position you had a ton of authority. You had some authority, but you didn't have a lot of authority. You also didn't necessarily always, you know, you were put in situations that could be dangerous as well. You had backup and things like that, but you really needed to think through situations and think about it from the other person's perspective as well, and what they may be looking at. You know, it's very similar to interacting with people on a daily basis, no matter what their level, but you need to think about it from their perspective instead of your perspective. You know, oftentimes you can see things differently if you just look at something through somebody else's perspective instead of constantly seeing it from your perspective. It's such an important skill to have, especially as you're going through and growing in organizations, because there's going to be different stakeholders who have different perspectives and different needs and different wants, and try to navigate that. Sometimes all at the same time. Sometimes they're all in the same room, so that can become challenging.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that is really insightful. The idea is that you, as a community resource officer, police officer, whatever the specific title is, but it wasn't a uniformed sworn police officer, so you didn't have the same authority, if you will, walking into the room. There was no gun on your hip. There was no ability to, maybe you could arrest somebody, I'm not sure, but like you couldn't do the same things that a sworn police officer did. If you needed to do the things that police officer did, you had to call the police officer and get them there. So
exactly.
So you now had to really think hard about how and what you said and realize the power of the language and the approach much more than anything else, because that was keep it from going south on you. If you will.
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah. You really had to think ahead and think on your feet and really understand the situation holistically from different perspectives and not just from, well, I'm the sheriff here, whatever your attitude may be and whatever it goes, because that may not be true.
Yeah. And of course that touches on a little bit of a, you know, sometimes that's a criticism of police departments, is that people in authority and, you know, an officer in authority, and I'll be cautious to, you know, so we don't get flamed on the podcast, but that is not all of them. But there's certainly authority can be corruptive in nature. in the idea that people can, it can kind of go to your head, if you will. You'd be like, I'm in charge here. And then that becomes the backstop rather than thinking through how you have to solve the situation without resulting to just essentially, you know, browbeating somebody with the authority that you possess.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's so important to remember that, you know, appreciate everything that police officers do, but that perspective that you just gave, that goes right into the boardroom, right into mm-hmm. even in IT. So my job is not to come in and say, this is the way that it's going to be done. Mm-hmm. Not my leadership style. I need the smart people around me who are going to help me make the decision, because they're the ones who really have a really good understanding for what needs to happen here. I need to get them the resources that they need. I need to break down any blockers that they may have. And then I need to lead them as a group towards the goal and give them the why for why we're doing this particular thing that we're doing, whether it's a project or, you know, whatever it may be. That's so important to remember, because if you, you know, I have worked for leaders in the past who really think that, you know, they do get that's a authority figure, if you will, and it's going to be my way or the highway. And unfortunately, it doesn't work out very well for them, because they just manage through fear. You're only going to attract a certain type of employee, and you're only going to get a certain longevity out of employees when you have that type of attitude towards mm-hmm. you.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Happy employees are, and satisfied employees who are, they're more productive. Like, I mean, to have staff that enjoys the work and doesn't feel fear for showing up, if you will, about like what thing might happen, who's going to fly off the handle today. What if this goes wrong, these people would be super pissed off. Like generally speaking, that's not a recipe for high functioning success. You can get success in that moment. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, there's plenty of examples of people who, you know, show up and are kind of jerks to everybody and they get the results they need, but it's fleeting in a lot of ways most of the time. It lasts only for a certain period of time. It can only be sustained for short bursts. So you create these like houses of cards that are not sustainable over time, where the next person that takes over and they're like, why is everything falling apart? And it's like, well, you know, shocking news, but you know, here's what happened before. There's a lot of history there in leadership where that type of work. I think I feel like there was just a news article that I saw recently. It was something about narcissists or something like along those lines, and how they ultimately could be more successful than you think, but you think about the trail of like destruction they could leave in their wake as they plow through getting stuff accomplished, you know. And there's even very successful examples of some of this out there, like, you know, Steve Jobs. I mean, I'm not saying Steve Jobs, narcissist. I'm not capable of diagnosing somebody with that. But the efforts that he would force out of people and the way he would treat them is certainly well documented. And it was brutal at times to get, you know, Elon Musk, I guess, is today's example of that as well. You know, he seems to be pretty crazy. But, you know, in terms of how things are going. But at the same time, there's obviously a lot of success. I mean, look at what SpaceX has done. Look at where he carried Tesla. So there's a balance to be had where sometimes I do not want to get caught saying that it's necessary for people to do that, because I don't explicitly think that. But it does. It's not unheard of for there to be success even when people behave badly.
Yeah. Well, and the examples, as you pointed out, I mean, those are high level examples. I mean, you think about how many Steve Jobs there are, how many Elon Musks.
Yeah.
You know, there's a reason why we know their names. So yes, it may be something that somebody may be able to try to achieve, but obviously it's a very, very tough place to get to. So even with that leadership style or with another leadership style, you know, they're definitely going to, it's not going to be an easy road, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm gonna turn to some more, I would say, lighthearted discussion here.
Yeah.
For the podcast. So one of the things that I always like asking folks who have histories, you know, long histories in various industries, can you share a story with us of something that you can look back now on and it's very humorous to talk about, but it was a bad situation or a bad thing that happened? And I'll give an example to start, so, you know, lay a little groundwork for you. One time, this is probably almost 20 years ago now, it was probably 2006, 2007, I was doing work for a customer. I was an IT consultant at the time, and they had a server room that was filled. We had an AS400 and some other equipment and all their servers. And I wasn't responsible for the AS400. I was responsible for some Windows servers that were there, and no cable management. So there was just a spaghetti pile of cables behind everything. You kind of see where this is going.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yep. And so I gingerly step on their giant pile of cables because that's the only thing you can do. And that was expected that that's what I was going to do, you know, in the afternoon, go back there and do some plug-in. And next thing you know, the guy who runs the S400 comes barreling into the server room with me and the network admin. And he's like, what'd you guys do? And we're like, we didn't do anything. What are you talking about? It's like, something's wrong with the AS400. This thing's like, it's not working. And they're a manufacturing company. And so, yeah, this is, it instantly affecting like production machinery and stuff like that. And it turns out that because of this, the various spaghetti nest of cables, one cable laid on top of another, and they were rubber, and this rubber is pulling on that rubber, and this piece is pulling on that, that the expansion chassis for the AS400's plug had come out. Not fully. It hadn't dropped out. So like we're looking and we look behind, we're like, everything's plugged in. It looks fine. And it turns out that it had pulled it out just enough to disconnect it. So it took a long time to figure that out. And so, you know, good laugh about it now. But, you know, like that's like almost your worst nightmare as the IT consultant walking in the door and being responsible for taking out the core production system while you're there. So that's my story.
Back in those days, it was always fun too, because you always knew who did something because it was the person who was in the server room. Yeah. Because we didn't necessarily, you know, we didn't have remote as much, you know, mm-hmm. So you had to go in, you had to counsel into things, you had to actually be physically in the server room. So it was always like, something goes down, you would immediately stand up in your cube and look in the server room. Who's in there?
That's right. Obviously, it's Doug's. Doug must have been doing something. I consulted Doug. He was the problem.
It's now much harder to blame people because anybody can be anywhere. But yeah, back in those days, it was really easy because it was like, who's in the server room?
Wow. So what funny story could you share with our listeners?
Yeah. So, you know, so many different examples, you know. No matter what example I come up with, the thing that I always remember is when I was a consultant for Microsoft, there was somebody that I worked with, and what he told me was, an expert is somebody who has made all the mistakes already. And mm-hmm. that really stuck with me all the time, because as a junior person, you're always feeling like you're making, how many more mistakes can I make? How many more mistakes can I make? And then you have somebody who's senior that tells you something like that. It's like, okay, this is a journey we've all been on. But I had a similar experience when I worked for a bank. We lived in Fargo, North Dakota at the time. And I was working for a bank, and I was on the server team, but I was doing some networking work for some reason, and went in and unplugged some of the cables, came back out of the server room, and the network guys were on me right away. What did you do in there? Tell me about what you unplugged. What were you doing? Turns out I took down all of the ATMs. I think we had something like, I don't know, 300 locations or something like that. I took down all of the ATMs in all of the locations. Yeah. So that was, didn't want to do that one again. That's for sure.
That's a big outage. 300 ATMs across North Dakota all at once. So like that would almost be like a newsworthy thing. Like they'd be like, oh, you know, whatever, you know, let's just call it North Dakota State Bank. North Dakota State Bank had an outage of all their ATMs. And you could be like, that was me.
And to make it
one
worse,
guy,
the bank was just headquartered out of North Dakota. It was across the entire Western United States. We went all the way to California.
Ooh.
Yeah.
so yeah, like, what kind of trouble did you get in with that? Hopefully you didn't lose your job. I mean, it was like you get admonished. They're like, look, yeah. Like you can't do this. Like,
right. But that's another great lesson. So for me in particular, you know, tell the truth. This is what mm-hmm. I did. Okay. We just went back and we replugged what I had unplugged, but, mm-hmm. but that is a great lesson, because at another location that I worked at, very similar, where it was back in the days where we had a council that was in the server room. You know, there was a major outage of, I think it was, I can't remember what system, but there was a major outage of a system. It was a big deal, because it was going to be revenue impacting. Mm-hmm. And the person that was in the server room, he's like, I didn't do anything. I don't know what you're talking about. And he stuck to that for like mm-hmm. 2 hours. And if we finally figured it out, what he had done, but because he had lied about it the whole time, that was a career limiting move for him.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So he wasn't in that business any longer. And he was one of the senior people and one of the people who was thought to be key of that organization. Like, we can never lose Joe, let's say his mm-hmm. name. You can never lose Joe. But it turns out Joe is expendable when Joe lies. And that's a great lesson for all of us. You know, something happens, tell the truth, mess up to it. We'll figure out how to move forward. But if you can't tell the truth, then how am I going to trust you with anything else?
For sure. Yeah, that's we had one time. So I was a county CIO for many years, and this happened in another county that I became CIO for. But it was before I was this county CIO. This incident happened, and they had it was a slightly different scenario, but they had a malware infestation, you know, so the email compromise type of deal.
Sure.
And you could see on the logs where the people clicked. You know, they'd be like, oh, here, click this link, and they'd click it. And then, but the way they conducted the interviews, and this, I think, to be honest, this is actually a lesson on how not to do the follow-up and investigative work for this. But this is like general staff in the county, not the IT people, but general staff. They have email compromise. Somebody's important email gets compromised. They send out all these things. Hey, click on the link. Look at this thing. And of course, staff is like, oh, well, you know, John sent it. It's from John's email. I'll click on the link. And then they do. And then, you know, so they fell for it. And when they got interviewed by the security folks, which they had a security team in, not an IT security team, but like a security, like guns on their hips security team,
okay,
investigating this. They pulled people in and they'd be like, can you tell us what happened to this? And they'd be like, I don't know what you're talking about. These people had lied right to their face. And they'd be like, the log says you clicked on it, you know, like, and it's because these people were scared, you know. And the lesson I guess I'm surfacing is that when there's a problem as a leader, how you handle it is as important as is the resolution. So like, if you want to know what's going on, you can't make it appear to everyone that they're going to lose their jobs. You know, so in this case, like at this county that I worked at, they're one of the few that still has like an internal security division separate from the sheriff's office. It's a super weird setup. But as a consequence, they have a tendency to investigate all this internal stuff. So when this email compromise happened, it wasn't left to the IT security group to conduct the interviews that were necessary to understand what had transpired. The security folks like piled in, you know, oh, we're going to figure this out. And so it was like the FBI showed up to investigate. And so suddenly everyone was like, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't click on this. And they're like, they'd be like, well, they said they didn't click on it. We'd be like, well, the log says they did.
Yeah.
And so like it actually impeded their ability to figure out what was going on because of the way they chose to conduct the investigation. They gave everyone the impression that the investigation was essentially like a criminal enterprise because of who was asking the questions of them. Somebody shows up with a gun on their hip and a badge, and they're like, can you tell us what happened here? You're going to be like, do I need a lawyer?
Exactly. Especially when you're talking about security rather than actual police. And it's like, it gets really convoluted.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyways, let's dispense with the heavy talk. So it is, you know, we're kind of coming to the last few minutes of the podcast here, but this episode, but I just ask another like question in your past. So what thing would you share that people may not know about you? And just as usual, I'll start with one myself. I was once in the Macy's Day Parade when I was a kid, in a marching band at that. So
very nice. Yeah, the one that I would share is just an example of maybe playing the odds, if you will. So I was working at an organization, and they sent out an email that they wanted some kids to be on a billboard in Lambeau Field, where the Packers play. And
it's a very Wisconsin thing.
It is a very Wisconsin thing. So I noticed the email was only going to, you know, let's say 400-ish people. Well, how many of those people actually have kids? Well, I have, my kids are super cute. Of course, I would of course think my kids are cute. So all we had to do was send in a picture. So send in a picture of my kids, and sure enough, they were chosen to be on the billboard. And I went to the photo shoot with them along with my wife, and it turns out that they thought the idea was going to be kids on the billboard. They decided, oh, let's try the parents now, since the parents are here as well. Uh-huh. So we all got dressed up in our Packer garb, and which, by the way, in Wisconsin, we just keep that in our trunk. It's
always there.
Yeah.
Does that include the cheese?
Yeah, okay. It's going to break out at any minute, though. So we put on the garb, we get our picture taken, and lo and behold, they choose to go with the adult picture rather than the kid picture.
Oh, so you stole the thunder from your own kids.
No, my kids.
I had no idea.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so it's, you know, being in Lambeau Field on a billboard for several years, that was always fun, because you would go to a game and you'd be like, hey, there I am right up there. And it was always there for you.
Oh my God, that's a pretty cool story. Sometimes you never know with some of those things. You go, you roll into this and you're like, oh, this thing will happen, and then they're like, oh, but we like this over here.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, that is cool. So I get to ask this because I'm in upstate New York and you're in Wisconsin. So language, these are language, funny language things. Is it soda or pop where you're at?
It is pop.
It is pop. You're in pop land.
Oh, I am in pop land. In fact, my son the other day, he was asking where the bubbler was.
Oh, I was going to ask that with one of the other ones, the bubbler or the water fountain.
Yeah, I thought he was talking about like the soda bubbler. And I was like, no, I don't have any bubbler. And turns out, and then finally he said water fountain. And I was like, oh, yeah, gotcha. Sure. Hmm.
And so let's see. Is it kitty corner or catty corner?
We are kitty corner here.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm kitty corner.
But we do say catty corner on occasion just to be fun.
Yeah. So let's see, I got some more here. Is it a semi-truck, a tractor trailer, or an 18-wheeler?
Oh, wow. I didn't even know that was a thing.
Apparently, yeah.
Semi-truck, I think.
Yeah.
They're kind of used interchangeably here.
Yeah, probably.
Semi-truck.
Oh, sneakers or tennis shoes?
Tennis shoes.
Your tennis shoes, yeah. Yep. Yeah. I'm in sneaker land here.
You're in sneakers?
There's sneakers here. So, all right. So, I always love asking this one too. Star Trek or Star Wars? Or neither?
That's a tough one. I guess I'm going to have to go with Star Wars just because.
Oh, you're a Star Wars guy.
Yep.
I'm a big Star Trek guy.
The one that I always like to ask my kids is Darth Vader good or bad? It depends, right?
Depends on the moment, right?
Exactly.
When he's throwing Palpatine down the middle of the Death Star, he seems like he's probably okay in that moment, right?
Right. Exactly. So I always make him think about that, like start to break their brain. Is he good or bad?
All right. So. Last question here, back to more serious topics on the podcast, but last bits of advice. So you're sharing our listeners are diverse leaders from across the spectrum. Some are up and coming, some are just learning, getting their first roles. You've been in multiple leadership roles for a while. What advice do you have for them that you think would be the most important pieces of insight to share about becoming a leader?
Yep, absolutely. So there's two of them that I'll leave you with. So the first one is there is no starting gun. So oftentimes I run into individual contributors who feel like they haven't been empowered, who feel like they need to be asked to do something or told to do something. But I've found in life there is no starting gun. Like just start doing it, and people will notice, and then they'll just continue to let you do it, most likely. So. Oftentimes it's ask for forgiveness rather than asking for permission. That's one that I see a lot of people miss. They think that they've got to wait until somebody tells them that they can do something. And then the one that I would leave you with is, you know, really trying to get your guiding principles, your direction that you want to set for yourself. Because as you've already described, we all have very individual and unique journeys throughout our careers, throughout our lives. So whenever I'm mentoring somebody, the question that I like to start out with that they should think about is what does success look like for them when they're 80? So if you're 80 years old, you're looking back, what did success look like? It doesn't necessarily have to be in work. It can be in life. It can be in general, because that should really be what guides you rather than, hey, Joe told me I should do this. And Tim told me I should do this. And Sally said I should do this. You know, those people have unique journeys as well. And their paths may have worked for them. It may not work for you though. So if you have a good understanding for what you want in the end, then you should have a good direction on how to get there.
Yeah, and I think I might just tag onto that slightly and say, when you're looking back, be the awareness when you ask that it may not all be career, right?
Right.
Like there's more to it to look back on than just the, hey, I, you know, spent 50 years doing this work. That may only be one part of what you think you want to look back on and have success at.
Exactly. It's a great point.
Awesome. Hey, Chris, well, thank you so much for investing your time with us on the podcast today.
Thank you, Doug. I really appreciate being here. And if anybody has any questions, feel free to reach out. Thanks.
That's a wrap on today's episode of Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. I'm Doug Kameen, and we look forward to coming to you on our next episode.